The Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins is brought to you by two great sponsors, Mack Weldon and Latote. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Also, the opinions and analysis of our guests belong to our guests. Enjoy the program.
I'm Dee Watkins, host of Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, here with my co-host, Justine Barron. She's a political and nonprofit consultant by day and a film and TV writer by night. We're also joined by Lisa Snowden McCray, who's an associate editor and reporter at Baltimore City Paper, where she writes on a whole bunch of topics ranging from hard news to parenting issues to music and arts. Also joined by Sarah Elkins. She's been an attorney at the Maryland Office of the Public Defender since 2012. And, you know, we have a whole lot of things to talk about with this extremely diverse panel. We all have different experiences and we do different things. And if it's okay with you, Justine, I want to start with Sarah. I want her to take us through, you know, everything she knows about a person who's being charged, you know, with a knife and what they go through in court. Because from my perspective, you know, I feel like I really want our listeners to understand that it's like we have two different court systems. I feel like if I was a white man walking down the street with a knife, then maybe I would like to chop some, you know, maybe I would like to carve an apple. You know, maybe, you know, if I'm a white guy walking down the street with a knife, maybe, you know, maybe I'm using it just in case my seatbelt gets stuck. Maybe I want to try to protect, you know, like an old woman from gang members. I'm, you know, I'm just an all-American white guy with a knife.
Or maybe you're a construction worker.
Maybe I'm a construction worker, you know, but if I'm a black person with a knife, then I want to perform massacres on all types of innocent people, or I'm in a gang. So I would love for you to talk about that, but then I also want you to, you know, we'll kind of segue into just that reality of you being that person who has to defend or fight against that.
Sure. Well, I don't know numbers in Baltimore City regarding knife arrests and charges. I do know that as far as I can recall in my cases, they've all been African-American defendants who've been charged with carrying a switchblade. And it's always two charges. It's the Baltimore City Code switchblade and the Maryland State Code prohibition against carrying a concealed dangerous weapon, which also includes a switchblade.
What's the difference? Because in a heated moment, it doesn't really matter of what kind of knife you stab someone with. You're going to stab them. It doesn't matter if, you know, you got to press down a button and pull it up with your other hand, or if it flicks right out, or if it's the kitchen knife, or if it's the Miracle Blade from television. If you're going to stab someone, you're going to stab them. So what's wrong with switchblades? To be clear, you know, to people who didn't hear the episode, Freddie did not have a switchblade. The knife he had was legal, and I'm sure, you know, Justine has insight on that, but I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know what the history of the legislation is. I can only assume that it's race-based in Baltimore City because most Baltimore City code police ordinances seem to be race-based, including the dirt bike charges and switchblade charges, taser charges, and that kind of thing. So the Baltimore City Code police ordinance says, it shall be unlawful for any person to sell, carry, or possess any knife with an automatic spring or other device for opening and or closing the blade, commonly known as a switchblade knife. That's punishable by a maximum of 1 year and a fine. The Maryland Criminal Code prohibition against carrying a concealed dangerous weapon specifically lists definitions, and in the definition section, weapon includes a dirk knife, bowie knife, switchblade knife, star knife, sand club, metal knuckles, razor, and nunchucks. And it says specifically weapon does not include a handgun or a pen knife without a switchblade. So there's case law and commentary that sort of defines what a switchblade is. And there's also information in the proposed jury instructions that talk about what a switchblade is, which includes: a switchblade knife is a device with a spring-operated blade that, when released, flies open and locks into place. And so we know that that doesn't apply to the knife that they tell us was the one found on Freddie Gray.
But I do want to go back and touch on something you said about the way you feel it's race-based as far as in Baltimore City and how it works. Could you explain?
Again, I don't know what the legislators were thinking when they put this specific code into place. I do know how I see it being enforced. And it goes along with what you were saying earlier about how if a white person is walking with a toolbox and they have that knife in their pocket,
maybe he's going to carve a pumpkin for Halloween.
Right. They're not the ones getting harassed.
Right.
This happens, you know, I almost never see charges that are just switchblade charges. It's either switchblade with drugs or switchblade with trespass in the case that Justine was referring to in the last week's episode. Oftentimes it's found as a result of an arrest.
Right.
For something else. But in that case from a few weeks, from the walking on the tracks that Justine had referred to previously, that could have been a citation. That gentleman could have been written a citation and released for trespass and come to court at a later date. Instead, he was arrested because of the knife that was found on him after he explained to the officers that it was for work. It was for work purposes.
And that was your client?
That was my client.
Yeah, so can you just tell us, give us more of what happened with the case, please?
People cross the light rail tracks all the time to get from point A to point B. And in this case, people had crossed at the same location so many times that there was a path worn in the grass where people are crossing the tracks to get from point A to point B instead of walking to the nearest street to cross over. So he was stopped for walking across the tracks for trespass, and an officer saw a knife clip sticking out of his pocket and subsequently recovered the knife and charged him with the trespass, the dangerous weapon, carrying it concealed, as well as the city code prohibition against carrying a switchblade.
To say he like allegedly found the knife clipped, it seems like a lot of these probable cause statements, the knife is clipped, you know, and they could see the clip on the outside. It just seems unlikely to me that that would happen as often as they say. You know, people can also just carry the knives in their pockets, right?
Yeah, but it has a clip for, you know, for easy access. And so let's say you're, you know, down on one knee working on a project and you need to get into the knife instead of having to stand up and dig into your pocket to get something. It makes sense that it's clipped and easily accessible.
You also don't even need a reason. You don't need a reason to have these. They sell these knives in every convenience store. They sell these knives all over the city. They're in Walmart. They're in Target. Like, why do you even need to have a reason? Or why are you stopping a person because you see a clip on a knife? Why aren't you stopping the stores from selling these knives?
Well, and we actually talked about that. The officer who gave testimony about the knife admitted that you can buy it across the street at the 7-Eleven and that they're commonly found and commonly sold in Baltimore City and in the surrounding areas. And that is a big issue. If you think that this is an illegal thing to possess, it's pretty easy to find them in stores and go after the store owners for having them and possessing them. Those store owners are possessing them. Why aren't they
being charged?
Maybe
you don't get those high stats if you stop the store owners from selling knives that you're stopping people for.
Right. And in this case, my client was on probation. And so I had to go report to his probation agent that he got a new dangerous weapon charge. I mean, that sounds bad. That sounds like he's a bad guy. And luckily, there wasn't a violation that was issued for him. But there could have been. And he could have been held without bail pending the result of my case, you know, just because the officer said this is a crime that he's carrying this knife around.
Doesn't it sound really stupid? Like, this is what we spend our money on. You know, I look at my check, I look at the stub, and I see the taxes that I extracted from it every week. And I'm like, come on. Like, come on. It doesn't make any sense.
Right. If you stab somebody with a knife, you charge them with assault. Yeah. So that's the crime. Having the knife itself shouldn't be the crime.
I mean, spending the time to get a police officer to get on a stand and talk about a knife that he knows you can find in a store. Yeah, I'm going to stop a person and charge him and say they got a dangerous weapon.
Right.
What is the logic behind it? I'm confused.
I've grown incredibly passionate about this issue. And part of it for me is, you know, none of this was mentioned at any of the trials because the state's attorneys, for a lot of complicated reasons, decided to go with that they held him too long if that was an illegal arrest. Now, fair enough. So that kind of invalidated the whole knife issue because the arrest happened before the knife was discovered. I think there are other reasons. But, you know, to me, the trials functioned at best as kind of a referendum on policing. So now people are seatbelting more and, well, theoretically, at least the policies are stricter and they're getting medical attention more often, theoretically. Well, this could have been a great issue to bring to the public's attention. You know, here we had a chance, even if it never ended up with a guilty verdict, for people to talk about these knives. And Mosby's office just crept away from the issue. It was too complicated politically for them, in my opinion, not just legally, you know? And it's very upsetting to me because some of these other issues that they've brought up are very challenging. Police practice versus policy and Terry stops and arrests. Those are very complicated to challenge. Whereas if we can get public awareness that all of these knives are legal, they're not switchblades, then cops can no longer claim ignorance of the law or reasonable misunderstanding. You know, that's why I'm so passionate about this, because I feel like this trial could have been a really great opportunity, and it started that way, to say we're not going to do this anymore. But I don't know, maybe the state's attorney was worried about implicating themselves with the number of these kind of crimes that they've prosecuted or at least sent to trial.
And it's interesting because Marilyn Mosby came out and said this knife was not a switchblade. But that message never trickled down to the line attorneys in district court who are determining whether or not to prosecute these cases. While the Freddie Gray case was going on, we were defending these switchblade cases with knives that looked exactly like the knife that they purport to recover from Freddie Gray. And still they continue to prosecute them. Now, to be fair, in my personal experience, I've seen less of these cases come through since Freddie Gray's arrest and trial, but are still coming through. So I'm still seeing arrests from these. It's usually a drug arrest, and then they find a knife and they call it a switchblade. And so they add the charge because they can. And so I'm still seeing the state prosecute these cases, which is, you know, blows my mind after Mosby comes out in public and says, this is not a switchblade. So there's some disconnect between, you know, her public.
Then you got to go back and worry about all of those other cases.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
But what's wrong with that? What's right is right. And what's wrong is wrong. And it seems like everyone has so many excuses on not doing what's right.
I'm from the Annie Jones era, when homicides was high. Every night you hear a group of bullets flying through the sky. West side be getting money, but it's different on my side. Lord, 14.
Hi, Undisclosed fans, it's Dennis, and I am back to talk about Mack Weldon. You know how much I love Mack. I rock the shirts, the underwear, the socks, and I love to tell you about how awesome Mack is. Look, this isn't just an ad spot I'm reading to get you to go buy the gear. This is me telling you that I wear Mack Weldon every day because it's the absolute best clothing I've ever owned. Literally, like, I wear it every day. I dare you to go find a recent pic of me not wearing Mack Weldon. Undisclosed live addendum? Yeah, I wore the black Mack Weldon V-neck. At the Innocence Network conference in San Diego last month, same style shirt, and I was wearing a pair of the underwear from the Silver Line, if you must know. You probably mustn't know, but I'm going to tell you anyway. Seriously, Mack Weldon is better than whatever you're wearing right now. Also, I know that about 68% of our listeners are female, and you might be thinking, I'm not all that interested in wearing men's underwear. But if you are, that's cool too. All I'm saying is, if you've got that significant male other in your life, get him some Mack Weldon. He's going to look a heck of a lot better and be more comfortable too. And Mack Weldon wants him, and you if you're wearing those underwear, to be comfortable. So if you don't like your first pair, you can keep it, and they will still refund you. No questions asked. So go get you some. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off using promo code UNDISCLOSED. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code UNDISCLOSED. Mack Weldon, it's better than anything you're wearing right now.
So Lisa, you covered this for City Paper. Give us some insight from your perspective and what you thought was going on when some of these things initially started.
I guess I'll talk with a question that you asked before we started taping. You were asking, you know, was I working for City Paper when this started? And actually it was when I first started writing for City Paper. And I was going to court every day, and I was turning in these very, like, news writerly pieces. And my editors were like, we don't want that. Like, we want your experiences. So once they told me that, it was a lot easier, because it's a weird place for me as a black woman reporter to be in that courtroom. There's very few, I think there was maybe two or three other black reporters, and they were, you know, City Paper is an alternative paper, so we get to say a little bit more, and like I tell people, we get to cuss. So, but they're, you know, they're all for publications like the Washington Post and NPR, where they have to be very strict. So,
is this your first time spending a lot of time in a courtroom?
Yes.
Okay.
And so what I saw was basically systemic racism in action. I saw lawyers literally stand up and say, you know, Freddie Gray caused his own death, and Freddie Gray is not in the courtroom to defend himself. And I saw a lot of perception issues. That's what I ended up writing a lot about, that were things that can't fit into a court proceeding, because court isn't about perception. Court is about black and white. But that had a huge bearing on this case. Like, you know, if you see someone, like kind of like what you guys were talking about with the knife, if you see someone and automatically assume that they're guilty and all of your actions go off of that perception, you know, assumption, that's how this started. But there's no way to really go into an officer's mind and say, you know, this officer has been taught since birth that black skin equals dangerous and bad. So it was really frustrating to see, and also to feel what I felt, but also still want to make sure that I'm bringing the truth, if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. So when they told you to come back and they told you to report with more, I guess, more emotion, what changes, or what did you come back with, or how did you?
That's when I put in the things that weren't able to have weight in court. Like I said, the fact that seeing a small group of black people who are concerned because they see this man screaming and, you know, having an issue, all of a sudden that becomes an angry mob where the officers are like, oh, it was this giant, you know, everything was out of control. So we had nothing, we couldn't do anything but shove him in the back of the truck and keep moving to the next stop. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, with that crowd of concerned people, been an angry mob if they were white people, if they were in Federal Hill, if they were in the county, if they were in White Marsh.
If they were celebrating an Orioles win.
Right, right. Or University of Maryland win or whatever. So that was the thing that was frustrating. And also I think being in a crowd of white reporters, because the way that they had it was that the reporters all had one section of the courtroom and then it was everybody else in the other section. So we're literally, you know, it's full.
Could you feel the tension?
No. And that's what was frustrating. Because for these other reporters, especially, you know, the white ones, this is just their job. You know what I mean? So, you know, they're talking and laughing in the breaks. And it's just very strange to see that the truth about this case was in the hands of this handful of people that are there, and most of them are white. So they're not going to feel it the same way. None of them would ever have a Freddie Gray in their family. So that was frustrating, too.
Part of what we're going to cover later in the season is media coverage of this case. And when you talk about the backgrounds of the reporters and the kind of work that they do, I have found that they've been consistently kind of had a tunnel vision around getting information from the police and very limited fact-checking or skepticism about that information. So that mainstream coverage of the Freddie Gray case has been, I mean, very simply put, police PR, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's actually an issue that we have, like, in general. Our stance at City Paper is the police are a version of the truth, just like a man standing on the street that says, I saw XYZ, is a version of the truth. And that's why often we don't get the same, you know, nobody tells us about when the police are having a press conference because they don't like us as much because of that.
It benefits the system to make it look like the cops can do no wrong. I want to loop you back in to the conversation, Justine, about this knife, because I really, really think we need to just get something concrete on the problem with these knives you can buy at the store and then go to jail for. I'm stuck on that. It's like the most ridiculous thing. I just don't understand.
Yeah, I wish I had an answer for you. There's this circular logic happening within BPD. Everyone is convinced that a spring-assisted knife is a switchblade, and it's not. And it took me an hour in a Starbucks with a very interesting character, Zan Martin, who you hear, who's passionate about knives, to learn all of it. So the fact that cops are arresting for this day in and day out, I can't stand it. Yeah, I don't know what can be done about this, because it's going so far as that they're suing Marilyn Mosby for this. If you read the lawsuits against her, they're stating in a lawsuit against the chief prosecutor in Baltimore that a spring-assisted knife is a switchblade, and it's just not. And anyone with any knowledge of this knows that. And I have to think the lawyers know it.
Yeah, I do you one better. Look, I've been in the streets my whole life, and I've probably only saw a real switchblade like twice. And I'm talking about, I've seen AR-15s, all types of assault rifles. I saw MAC-10s. I saw heckling cops. I saw all types of guns. I saw so many different types of guns in my life, so many different types of machetes and swords. And I've only saw, I mean, when I think switchblade, I think like the Fonz. Like it should come with like a cool leather jacket, and you whip it out and do you want any trouble? You know, that's what I think about. But I actually only saw real switchblades like maybe two times. How many cases do you come across with these knives, Sarah? What is your caseload like when people get locked up with these knives as switchblades, but they really aren't?
Well, almost all of them. I think I've seen one that would probably fall under the switchblade category, and that client took a plea. And that was a case where very clearly you pressed a button on the handle and the blade
and
flew
it
out.
It pops up. Yeah, you don't see those. Like, you can't buy those at gas stations.
Right. Right. Those aren't the majority of these cases. That's like the very, very small amount of these cases. Most of them, there's a button or a little knob on the actual blade that you exert pressure on to open the blade.
When
the officers bring it in, you know, I ask them every time I have a switchblade case, make your officer bring the knife in. I want to examine it. And they always open it very quickly to look like it's popping out, right? Mm-hmm. They use one hand and they, you know,
They shove their hand forward
and they fling it. You know, they do a flick of the wrist to make it look like it's flying open. But the flick of the wrist is really what's making it look like it's flying open, right? And it does open quickly, right? These are knives that are meant to be opened with one hand and open quickly.
What about the pyramid scheme company that sends the kids up and down the street to sell knives like Vector? Like, these knives are already out. So it's like, again, what's the difference between how the blade pops out of the handle? Because you can have, if I feel like my life is in danger, if I'm in a heated situation and I'm in some type of violent altercation, if I have to stab something and, you know, I hope I don't ever have to stab anything ever. But if I had to stab something, I don't think it would matter. Like, I think I would get the blade out. Doesn't matter if it's the push of a button, which is not the most convenient. The most convenient is a kitchen knife.
Right.
A kitchen knife is most convenient because it's already ready. Ready for you.
It's hard to carry that in your pocket.
You know, it's hard to carry it in your pocket. True. But it's ready.
Right.
Switchblades, you got to pop out. And then what are we calling these knives again? The one like they said Freddie had. What are we calling it?
Assisted opener.
Okay. So, again, like, these cops come in here and they try to act like it's a switchblade. And then what is your response to that?
Well, I take a look at it myself and I pull the blade out and I see if I think it's a switchblade
or
not.
You say, buddy, this is something from a gas station. This isn't a switchblade. And what do they say?
Well, they say, yeah, it's from the gas station and it's a switchblade.
Okay, so we need to get this on record. There's a number of Baltimore City police officers who don't know the difference between a switchblade and an assisted.
They refer to these knives as spring assisted, which we've looked at. I don't see anywhere that says the word spring assisted in the statute. We see assisted.
Yeah, Miller wrote that on Freddie's charging documents and all of them. I think one thing we have to think about when it comes to patrol officers is that they're incredibly young. You know, like the officers in this case, we have Lieutenant Rice and we have the van driver who are in their 40s. And Lieutenant Rice was, you know, supervising, supposedly. But the other officers are really, really young and they're getting their information from, a lot of them come from the suburbs, some of them come from Baltimore, but they're getting their information about these knives from their supervisors and everyone who works around them. So spring assisted is a switchblade. Yeah, I think some of them don't know better. And I talk to cops like almost every day, you know, our sources who are off the record mostly. Yeah, none of them got any training on this. And some of the even most advanced cops who were supervisors in Baltimore are still a little unsure. I think, here's the thing, if they were to learn about it, then they would have to change their practices. So sometimes ignorance is bliss and allows you to get your job done.
Well, and at the end of the day, they get to make their arrest and they get to keep quote unquote dangerous weapons off the street. And if the state's attorney can't prove the case during trial, that's not on the officer.
Common sense is not a job requirement. and I'm guessing that the people The people with the blades are like the street dealers, but the gas stations are like the big time kingpins because they have like cases of these knives floating around.
Yeah, I was just, and I think Justine kind of ended up at the point that I was thinking is training, because I'm wondering how these people are being trained to spot different weapons and know what is what. Because I know one of the things that was surprising to me sitting in on the case is how not official or thorough that training was. They did a lot of talking about how police officers were trained to put suspects in and out of the van. And so they had
people come on. So we know they failed that.
Right. Well, they didn't even have it really. Like, they would have a day where they'd maybe do it in like a regular chair. And maybe that might be it. Or maybe one day they would get a van and then they would do it for a day there. So it wasn't
do
like...
Do we have to hide? Why do we have to keep hiding behind training? That's something that really frustrates me too. They keep throwing it around like it's not common sense. We know that if you arrest a person for any reason, they're not supposed to die on their way to jail. We know if a person has... And I'm not a doctor. I don't even have a certificate. But I know that if a person has some type of neck injury or some type of spinal injury, you're supposed to stabilize the neck. I know the difference between a switchblade and a knife where you have to actually push the button and pull the blade out. I know the difference. We know these things. Obviously, I don't talk to as many police officers as Justine. She says she talks to cops every day off the record. I don't talk to as many police officers as Justine, but I know the police officers I had conversations with did not ever come off as clueless people. Actually, they're kind of snarky, and they're like Woody Allen characters. They're snarky, so I don't...
Well, and also, I just feel like from a common sense, you know, I've never trained to be a police officer, but I have worked, you know, as an adult within bureaucracy, so it's like...
Do you
like,
know what a switchblade is?
Yes.
You push the button, and it's pop.
Yeah.
Versus you holding the button down and pulling the blade out. You know the difference between those two knives.
Yeah. But I just know, okay, divorcing common sense from this, if you're running a government agency, any government agency, there's bureaucracy. There's always that, you know, the boring BS of having to check off lists. So if the police are really working in our best interests and they're getting our federal funds or our state funds or whatever, city funds, do a thorough job so you can at least just check it off the list if you actually are acting in our best interest. And it seemed like that wasn't done. Like, there was a lady that was training that she was just signing stuff off because she was like, I don't know, they told me to sign it off. And it's like, right there, you're making your own case weaker because you're not doing stuff the right way.
Right. And if they weren't training on the knives before, I mean, they certainly should be now.
Right.
Now that it's become an issue,
right,
there's no excuse for not having training on it now.
You know, Dee, when you were talking about common sense, this could be like an article or even a book, because it's almost as if certain jobs can brainwash away common sense. You know what I mean? Like, you're a new cop and you're seeing everybody do something a certain way, and you see them do it that way enough times, you might stop questioning whether or not it's right. Because, and then if you decide to be the one person who takes extra time to seatbelt in that van, which is very awkward, what is everybody going to think about you? So we're talking about a profession that has a very unique kind of code and way of living. And so that's where, if you had a drink in the bar with a cop, you might have a conversation where they seem to have a lot of common sense. And then you see them operating in the job and you're wondering where all of that common sense went.
Well, and there's a lot of incentives for shortcuts too. So, you know, trying to get more arrests, trying to get things done, trying to get there faster. You know, you have to write a report, so you're only going to put a few things in the report, enough to CYA about why you made an arrest, not to do a detailed and thorough investigation, because there's no incentive to do that. Once you make your arrest, you let the state's attorney figure it out from there. You're done. You do the arrest and you write the report and you're done.
And the show is not really about calling, you know, police officers morons or idiots, and I'm willing to sit down and listen to whatever a police officer would have to say in regards to any of these issues, especially if we're not getting it clear. But some of these things, why do you have to go to court over and over again and see people take a gas station knife that's 1,000% legal and make it look like it's not? Why? And this message is to all the Republicans out there. You know, I know you guys care about your tax dollars a lot. This is your tax money being spent in a stupid way, like it's bigger fish to fry. So you can't have a switchblade. I'm sorry, but you can, you can take a samurai sword and go stab a person in New York. Like, come on. Like, I'm just, It's crazy.
As long as it's not concealed, you're okay.
Well, it's interesting when you talked about Republicans, because if you think about like the pro-gun lobby, you know, this is also very racially segregated in terms of they want some people to have as many guns as they want and no laws limiting them, but they want to take the guns out of the hands of other people, pretty much black and white, you know?
Yeah, no, it's like it's no shortage of contradictions. They're like all over the place and always available, you know? So hopefully we can push the issue and really challenge some of these topics. When I caught my first gun charge, Lord, jugging, running crazy, we was gone hard. Me and B crept down on the boogin', but the gun jammed, so I couldn't complete the job.
Here's what happens nearly every time I go shopping. I wander around the store for an hour picking out items to try on, only to discover there's a long line of people waiting for the dressing room. The last time I made the mistake of going to a department store, I stood in line for 10 minutes before realizing that one dressing room had been occupied for a half an hour by a woman agonizing over a single pair of jeans, and the other wouldn't be free until the person inside had tried on nearly every single shirt the store sold. When another shopper basically body checked me in order to grab the last cold-shouldered blouse from the rack, I nearly lost it. Tossing my pile of clothes on top of a sweater display, I left the store in defeat. Thank goodness for Latote, the fashion subscription box service that sends brand name clothing and accessories right to your door. Sign up for as many totes per month as you'd like, fill out your style profile, and allow Latote's professional stylist to curate your look. Wear what you like, and then send the items back when you're done. There are no dressing room lines, no dirty laundry, just an ever-changing wardrobe from brands like Trina Turk, Blank NYC, and BB Dakota. Fashion shouldn't have to cost a fortune, and with Latote, you can get up to $700 worth of clothing for only $39 a month. Plus, no panic attacks. That's priceless. I love that Latote gives me the opportunity to try out trends I wouldn't normally risk spending my money on. Maybe I'll give one of those cold-shouldered shirt thingamajigs a try. To try it yourself, go to latote.com. That's L-E, tote, T-O-T-E.com, and get started for as low as $39 a month and enter promo code UNDISCLOSED to get 50% off your first month. Fill out your style profile and sign up to get a custom tote delivered right to your door. Wear what you want, return everything in the mail when you're done, and you'll get a new box within days. Again, that's latote.com. Enter my code UNDISCLOSED and feel fabulous with fashion delivered right to your door.
So, the blood, Justine, the blood and the samples and how these things were handled. How was that done in a way that was so irresponsible?
Actually, I want to ask Lisa a question about that because you were in the courtroom. Did you get a chance to sit through some of the testimony of these blood experts?
I did, but I will tell you that it's been a little while. Like, I tried to read up on what I wrote, but I don't have a lot of memory about that. So I might not be the best.
I was just curious because I only have trial audio to go on. And I just had this sort of sense of endless, tedious detail with, you know, not much of a payoff. I mean,
yeah. And I remember that they tested the seatbelt, the samples, the seatbelt of blood on the seatbelt. There was some matter that was on the wall. There was matter on the floor. Like, some of that was already there. Some of it was Freddie Gray's.
Did you feel like you were getting a story about how he died based on some of this evidence?
It felt like a story with missing pieces, big gaps of missing pieces. So, you know, yeah, I mean, it felt like there were a lot of gaps. And I remember specifically getting caught up on the fact that, you know, once he started, he was obviously in distress. And this is kind of getting away with what you asked me, but this is what it makes me think of, so I'm just keep talking. that they could have taken him to the hospital. And they were like, oh, no, he's fine. And that seemed like another thing that, like, just do it. Like, just even if you think that he's fine, it seems like, again, it covers your own behind if you just take him there. But they decided that he was just lying and... You know, they said that a lot of people lie to go to the hospital just so they don't have to go to central booking. But they brought a medical expert in from central booking who said that even when that happens, once they're checked out and fine, they're brought right back. So that was one of the huge missing pieces for me. That's like, why didn't you just do this? It would have saved everybody a lot of grief if this man was in, if he was claiming to be in pain, just cross that off the list. So again, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's just what it makes me think of from the trial.
No, it's interesting. I mean, we're going to talk a lot about that in an upcoming episode. But one thing I think about is you have six cops. Well, really, actually more. You know, we'll say seven, including Novak, plus there's others. But you have several cops who are witnessing distress, whether his neck was broken at stop one or not. He was in distress. That was obvious right. to anyone mm-hmm. who watches that video. And none of them make that move. And you have to think they're not all heartless people, every single one of them, monsters. So it does make you wonder what's really going on here.
And there have been studies that show that people tend to think that Black people are superhuman. So they think that we can, that even doctors, they tend to give Black people less pain medication because they don't believe us as much when we say that we're in pain. So that's what I was thinking also. So it's not that they're necessarily bad people. It's just kind of like the institution of racism.
It's like, all the way back to like J. Marion Sims and what he did with women and infants and those Black infants when he was trying to cure neonatal tetanus and he was like taking a shoe all and beating holes in their head. And of course he was killing these babies, but now he has a statue in Central Park. He's the father of modern gynecology. So it's like,
right, we're just beasts that can just take everything.
Interesting. No, that's actually an interesting way to look at it.
Freddie was very small, and he had, you know, lead poisoning mm-hmm. as a child. I suffer environmental illness myself. It's not an easy way to live. You have asthma. You have, you know, he was a small adult male, and the pictures of him that we see on the internet are when he weighed a little bit more, and he looks like a big tough guy. I mean, I didn't ever see him personally, but just from what I've heard and seen, he was a skinny kid, basically, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, I try to run everything by a few cops. I try to get three for every piece of information, just so that I'm sure, and usually at different levels, going all the way up to retired commanders, you know? And the van was one that everyone was pretty solid on. Like, that van should have been, it's a crime scene right away. It should have been put into evidence right away. So as you start to see all of these pieces add up, the strangeness of Novak handling the knife and the weird way that the van was handled, you'll start to see the things that went wrong. Because I know that we think that it's a hopeless case to ever be able to charge and prosecute cops. But there were some very specific things going on in this investigation that need to be revealed. Because the system was actually in place to be able to get stuff done correctly. And it wasn't done correctly. And some of that has less to do with policies. The policies are actually not bad. It's who was put in charge of things. It's going all the way up to Commissioner Batts. And so that's going to be interesting to keep exploring. And the cameras are a part of that. So,
do you know why the state's attorney brought up the blood in the van? Did they make some sort of explanation or tell a story to tie that to their theory?
The state's attorney, yeah. Their theory is that Porter put Freddie in a seat at stop four. So the blood proves that Freddie wasn't actually healthy at stop four. I don't even know where to begin with that, including did stop four even happen, which we're going to talk about. But that seems like a bit of a leap. It was a long ride, and there's a lot of places blood could have happened. And also, that van was out of evidence for a week. So who knows how that blood got there, right?
Right. That's really concerning that there was no testing done on the van immediately, or at least, you know, taking the van off the road. I mean, there's people in and out of there. There could have been hundreds of people. Who knows how many people were in and out of that van in between, you know, the stop of Freddie Gray and when the samples were actually taken.
Any amount of blood is what we don't know. Was it a lot of blood, or was it, you know, and it was reported that he had a nosebleed?
Yeah, some blood was coming out of his nose. That's the only blood that the paramedic saw.
But there was blood found on the panel behind him, right?
From what I remember, I know they were saying that it was dried blood that they had to, I guess, process to like scrape it off, kind of to test it.
It would be dried a week later.
Yeah.
Also, you know, and Justine, please correct me if I'm wrong, but people from the neighborhood said that there was an altercation before he actually got in the van, so the blood could have came from that. When he was folded or tackled or thrown on the ground.
And then you're wondering, the state's attorney, those are the people that we saw as heroes. I know I was really stirred by Marilyn Mosby's speech 2 years ago, taking on the cops. And yet they're not considering that possibility at all. They are using to fit the story that they brought to trial, a story that was based exclusively on a very thin amount of evidence from the police. So,
in that way, but using that system, you know, if you use that, if you think about it, everybody wins. So the people calm down, the community get what they want because the cops are actually being charged and it's historic. But then the cops get what they want because they actually get to go free.
Do people calm down if you mess up in some of the ways?
What are people doing right now? I'm in a lot of different worlds. So I'm in Baltimore City, but I'm really in Baltimore City. So I'm in academia, I'm in media, I'm in a lot of different other places too. And, you know, people will always remember Freddie Gray and what happened in our city. And people still talk about how horrible police are. So nothing has really changed on the ground level. Maybe some different things shifted in administration, but on the ground level, I just left a school full of eighth graders maybe like a week ago. And one of the number one things that they wanted to talk about is how much they hate police officers, how much they hate them, not ignore them, not, you know, stay away from them. But it was, there's a hate. There's a hate going on just because of the way that they are being treated. And these kids are young. So it's like charging them was enough to stop the unrest. But at the same time, the way they got off on this case is enough to make the police officers happy to a certain extent. I mean, the FOP is not, they're still, you know, in my opinion, this is me speaking. I think the people at the FOP are a bunch of heartless jerks. You know, they said some mean things. They had some mean tweets. They done some very disheartening things. But, you know, they just taking that victory lap right now by trying to sue, which is also going to cancel out, in my theory. I don't think they're going to win.
How many going to ride for me? How many going to die for me? How many going to ride for me? How many going to die for me?
I don't know what to say about the state's attorney's office. Like, it really, you know, I had to be critical of them too, and it didn't make me feel good to be critical of them, but it seemed like they did some things that, like, the judge was, like, looking at them, like, shocked. Of, like, how can you do this? Doesn't make any sense. Like, I'm thinking specifically during closing arguments, they started talking about some video that existed of a police officer being outside and yelling at people and saying, I'm going to put you all in jail. This is video that was never entered into evidence, was never referenced during the trial. And so the judge had to stop everything and take this from the record because he was like, what? And like the fact that there was all this evidence that could have been entered in and they just didn't turn it in time. And they said, oh, we didn't get it from police in time. It's like, okay, well, you... that's not a good enough example. And I just know, like, for me, like, as a Black person growing up, you're always taught you got to be twice as good. So I didn't understand, knowing that you were going into a situation where the system is set up against you, why there was space made for these blunders. And maybe, Dee, your theory is correct, because otherwise I don't get it.
I'm fishing here. I'm fishing because as I listen to these episodes and I look at, you know, some of the things are going to be found with, you know, really, really great investigative journalism, like the team, you know, like they did, you know, it's just what they do, and they took care of it. But there's some of these things that are just so, like, obvious that it, like, it makes my stomach hurt.
Like, literally, reporters are looking at each other in court like, what? Like, what is happening right now?
I think that's been, for me, the as an investigator, the biggest puzzle in the case was sort of trying to figure out how much from the state's attorney's office was incompetence, how much was, you know, purposeful compromise. And I feel like I've gotten closer and closer, and we really do mean to shed light on that. It's not like I'm keeping anything from you now. It's just very complicated. But I think all of your criticisms are incredibly valid. It's very, very disheartening. This could have been the trials of the century, the new, you know, the next OJ level trial with that level of importance, with the right criminal investigators and the right prosecutors with appropriate experience.
The lawyer who wins this case instantly would have got, like, you know, three elementary schools named after them over the next 20 years.
I mean, from the very beginning of this case, I don't know why the Baltimore City State's Attorney is the one prosecuting it. Like, that decision to have the Baltimore City State's Attorney, who has a very close working relationship every day with the Baltimore Police Department, doesn't seem like the appropriate
body to bring these charges. Marilyn Mosby could have asked any prosecutor in any other county in, or, you know, somebody from the state, from the AG's office, to bring in a special prosecutor to work on this case. They could have asked the federal government to get involved with the investigation and the prosecution of this case. But Marilyn kept the case for herself, and that's good optics, right? I mean, she got to say, well, I pressed the charges. I'm cleaning up the police department. You know, that's good optics for her. People loved her for that. Whether or not, you know, she wasn't the actual attorney prosecuting us, so, you know, they get to say, well, the jury found him not guilty. It had nothing to do with the prosecutor. It was the jury that decided that.
Would it have been hard, though, for her to find somebody? Like, she, you know, she's a black woman, so I think that maybe, would she have been able to find somebody else that would have taken the case on?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think if you're a prosecutor in another jurisdation and somebody asks you to spearhead this, then that's a good opportunity. It's a good career opportunity, and it's an interesting case to work on. I mean, I don't see why not. I don't know the answer to that. But if she had called the feds and said, we need your help on this case, you should take over the prosecution of this case, I can't see them saying no.
You think
no.
The outcome would have been different? Because the feds don't, you know, their closing rate is kind of high. They shoot a good percentage from the field.
They do great. Their investigations are thorough, and they don't bring the charges until they got the case, right?
No, and they don't have a sense of humor either. Like, when it comes to, like, you know, winning cases.
I mean, I just, you know, you have officers who are witnesses in your cases every day. Your state's attorney's office is working hand in hand with these officers to prove all the other cases that are brought. And then
it just doesn't make any sense.
And you turn around and say, now we're prosecuting you, but I'm going to have your colleagues investigate you.
So you think she should have pressed the charges and then she should have just did the pass off to the feds?
Or let somebody else do the investigation before determining the appropriate charges. I mean, it was clear that these charges came to quell riots or how they, you know, like the timing of these charges and the way that she brought them was saying, I want everybody to calm down and let the judicial system take its course. You know, we'll deal with this in the courts, basically. It happened so fast, and it seemed to be a direct result of all the unrest that was going on in the city. And it didn't seem so well thought through. And she went and, you know, committed herself to a timeline and a theory during that press conference that it's tough to then be like, well, I didn't mean that. Let's go with a different theory of what happened.
And now not only do people have an issue with the system, it's like it's been stripped now. It's even like a bigger issue because that gave people hope. And it's nothing worse than giving people a little taste of hope and then snatching it away in a way that was as historic as the charges actually being handed down. It was like a historic snatch.
That's really well put. That's why, you know, when I was thinking about when you said, well, everything is calm now, you know, and I think about a raisin in the sun, you know, this idea of like, does it shrivel up and die or does it explode? It's like things seem calm. Maybe people got, but there's an ongoing crisis of leadership in Baltimore and, you know, murder rates that won't calm down and discontent. So I think that in terms of what Lisa said before, you know, at what price was this sort of short-term gain, you know? What could trigger the next riot?
The problem is that the people who mainly participated in the uprise, these are the people who are actually the only ones paying a price. Those kids who stepped on that police car or the kid who cut that water hose, these are the young people that are actually facing jail time, not the officers who were very incompetent and performed in a way that was just goofy and ridiculous and unacceptable. You know, these guys are home. They're with their families. They're enjoying life. You know, they weren't even in jail long enough to get the jail stink on them. They wasn't even in there, you know. But these kids are facing time for the vandalism and some of those different things that came from that. So,
well, and what's amazing about that, what you're just saying, is that these officers, you know, weren't in jail too long, right? These are the people that have the highest flight risk out of anybody who was arrested ever because they have the knowledge to make IDs, to get around computer systems. They have,
they know the system,
and they've got money. Right? They've got jobs, so they got money saved away. They've got family all over the place, probably family they could go stay with out of town. You know, they probably have a passport, right? These are the people that present the biggest flight risk and have the most to lose, but it's the person who's stomping on the car who's held without bail, right?
Exactly.
The person who doesn't have a passport, doesn't have money, is a kid, and doesn't have family outside of the city of Baltimore. He's held without bail. And the officers, I mean, clearly they didn't run, right? But they did, in my opinion, present the highest risk of flight out of anybody involved in this whole situation, and they're the ones out on bail.
Think about it like this. Let's just say your big brother, your big cousin, your father, your uncle, whoever participated in the uprising, they were one of the people that was locked up. You're a little kid and you're watching that. You know what police officers do. You know a lot of them act in the way they shouldn't act. You know a lot of them are constantly harass and act evil towards you and your family and your friends. So you see some people who poke their chests out and fight back, bash the cop car, cut the water hose, smash up a store because they were tired. They were sick of being harassed. They were sick of people, you know, disrespecting their grandmothers, using all types of non-acceptable language to people in their neighborhood. So, you know, they wanted to step back and they wanted to strike back. They wanted to send a message. They wanted to send a message, right? And everyone, or so many of those people who tried to send that message, their lives are now ruined forever. So, you know, people in the activist community, some of them, you know, they'll get like money and they'll get like, you know, awards for speeches and things they do around what happened. Plenty of books have already been written. There's a whole lot of people who are benefiting, but the people who actually put that work in and did this stuff that we write about and we report on, a lot of those people are going to be done for the rest of their lives. Some of them are going to go to jail and not come home. Some of them are going to go to jail and never come home. What is your motivation to fight against injustice? What is your motivation? You strip it away because the cops got away. Mosby's going to be set. You know, she can go on and she can write a memoir and tour the world and she can do whatever she want to do. The police officers can do similar things. Somebody's going to be interested in their extremely twisted side of the story. You know, somebody's going to want a lifetime or something.
I think all one of them already got some kind of award from like.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like a Ku Klux Klan Appreciation Award. I don't know. That's not the name of the award, but an honorary robe. But
Like the Sun getting, like, it's just weird to see from my angle to see journalists getting awards. And I'm like, you know, I'm not going to turn down an award if somebody wants to give me one. But it also is gross to get an award on the backs of poor Black people.
But back to that little kid who's watching this, these are the people. But these are the people who we care about them. They're part of our community. You see this. What is your motivation to fight against this system? So you know you're not going to rebel because you're going to end up in jail. You know you can't go the legal route like Mosby did because it's scheduled against you.
No, they learned a really big lesson. The officers don't get in trouble, but you do if you stand up.
You wear black skin. You play in a different game. So this is what these young people have to look forward to. And I think it's anyone who sit back and has some type of power and is okay with this is you have to look at yourself in the mirror one day and, you know, you have to acknowledge that you're just a terrible person.
Give a nigga more problems than a mathematician. Playing games with real nigga, that's a bad decision. Ask me how I've been living.
You know, I'm too inside of this to really see, but the failure of these trials, do you think that that had any impact locally or nationally on the Black Lives Matter movement?
It's a great question because it's something that I don't even think that a person like myself could speak on. You know, people assume, like, not saying you assume this, but a lot of people assume that every Black person in this country is like affiliated or a supporter or in line with Black Lives Matter. So me, I'm a journalist. I'm in the world. I travel all over the place. I've met many of the top ranking activists who are a part of this. And, you know, they're great. They're nice people. They definitely have plans and agendas and they're making changes and they're great in their own right. But I'm from a very, very poor neighborhood. And when you come from these places, and I go to some of these places in different neighborhoods, you know, based on what my book is about and the kind of work that I do. And when I go to these places, I've learned that Black Lives Matter is kind of more like a middle class thing. People in the hood not running around talking about Black Lives Matter.
Baltimore doesn't have a Black Lives Matter chapter.
I think they do, though. I think Raquel run it. But it's not viral in the neighborhoods. It's amongst the activist community. So it's like, you know, if one of my friends gets shot by a cop or if one of my friends gets shot by somebody on the street. We're not going to march and organize, and we're not going to like hop on Twitter and form groups and hashtags. Either you're going to retaliate or you're going to ball up that pain and that anger. A guy explained this to me really good at an event I went to. You're going to ball up that pain and that anger, and you're going to let it out at the funeral. It's where you see people nodding and snot coming out their nose and they're throwing up because they letting that pain out in a different way. But if you like from like a middle class type black experience, you might not be used to that. I'm sure Freddie Gray, like me, like Kondwani, like all of us, we probably saw, I've been to so many funerals, I don't even know, I forget who's dead. I've been to so many funerals, and I'd be like, damn, why I ain't see Adrian in a while? Oh, yeah, he got killed. You know, Adrian got killed in 2011. Like, I've been to so many funerals, so it's not that type of situation, and it's a different thing. Not saying that Black Lives Matter don't care about, you know, poor people in certain neighborhoods, because that's definitely not true. I think they do. And I think some people from these neighborhoods, especially some of the younger people who are more on the social media, are in the Black Lives Matter. But I'm saying most of the people that's running the streets, that's living their life, that's going to work and all that, they're not really directly affiliated with the movement.
Isn't that kind of how organizing works? I mean, Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, they weren't in the fields. You know, sometimes it takes people that are a step back to help organize and make changes, right? So that you might need a middle class African-American movement to help make changes that may or may not impact what's going on in West Baltimore.
I met people at rallies. I mean, I met people at book events. I met other writers at book events who preach activist talk, but they don't know or address black people. Does this make any sense? They got all the rhetoric, the language. They got the T-shirts, the unapologetically black T-shirt on. They walking around with a little copy of James Baldwin in their hand as they march through the crowd. But they don't even know anybody from any type of neighborhood. Everybody they know got like Wi-Fi and like a doghouse. Like,
because that's why they get... You have to make white people comfortable to be able to have access to success. So if they're able to do that, they're usually not from a place like that. They're able to code switch and, you know, be like the cool one black friend. And so that's why those people aren't.
I'm teaching a workshop on making white people comfortable. If anybody's interested, it's like an online, you just sign up, it's online registration. You know, you come through, I tell you all about these different ways to make white people. There's cheeses and wine and, ooh, you know.
Well, the first thing you do is get an email address, right? I mean, it's amazing how many clients I have that don't have a way for me to contact them, don't have an email address or don't have a phone that's working. And, you know, these people aren't worried about activism. They're trying to get by from day to day.
Yes. Exactly.
That's what, when you were talking, Dee, it reminded me of when I was covering the city council races and I was interviewing this lady. She was a black lady who was running for the Green Party, and I wish I could remember her name. But she's from one of the really bad, you know, poor areas of the city. And she was like, we're working on basic stuff right now. You know, these are areas of the city that don't even have clean water, that don't have basic access to things. So they can't even accelerate to, like, you know, the level of activism because they need
what's
to have
hash,
basic
what's
stuff.
What's a Twitter account?
Like, you know, you wrote about this. You wrote about, you know, black people not even having access to the internet, which you need to be able to do anything in 2017.
Or identification.
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't know where your birth certificate is, you can't get an ID, you can't go to work. Or if you got to move all the time and you don't have bills in your name and you can't go to the MVA to get an ID because you can't establish an address, right? Then you can't get a job. I mean, there's so many systemic issues that people are dealing with. They're not talking about organizing on Facebook.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to call anybody out, but I'll say this. Tell a black person, a popular black person or a non-popular black person or just a black person on Twitter that's from like one of these neighborhoods, tell them to tweet for some support to like a top black writer who like writes about and speaks on these issues and see if they get a response, a retweet, a follow or anything. Just, you know, just see. And there you go.
I used to write for
because it's about accessibility, right?
Yeah, I used to write for the Afro-American, which is from his name, obviously a very black, a historically black newspaper in the city. And it was so hard to get certain black people to interview with us that would go to City Paper and The Sun, and we'd be begging.
So that's that. I think that Black Lives Matter is fighting a different battle than the everyday black person is facing in the city. A, I do get frustrated when they speak for them, because if you don't have proximity to a certain group, you shouldn't be speaking for them. And then B, I think that every black person believes that Black Lives Matter, and we know that we don't get a fair shake in the legal system or on television or in Hollywood or even in like certain parts of the music industry. So we all know that, and we're trying to survive. We don't even have time to like formulate some of these types of movements. So I think that's where the disconnect comes from. And I do want to take some time, Justine, if you can talk about Amelia's clip when she was talking about how Freddie and his friends weren't really doing or like participating in like drug dealer like activity when they were actually stopped, how they were just like walking down the street. And I believe that the story was they were going to go see about construction work, which is a real thing in the hood. Somebody said, yo, you really want to work? You really want to stop being a knucklehead? All right, man, come see me on Sunday, man. And I'm going to tell you what to do, the kind of job, and get some work. That's one type of situation. Then the other type of situation is like, in which I don't think I heard in the episode, but I just want to be very clear on. When you are hanging around your drug dealing friends, you are not in contact with your non-drug dealing friends. Rarely. It's a rare thing. And I'm not talking about like when you're working as a drug dealer and you on the clock. When you on the clock and you working, you are not hanging around. Your non-drug dealer friends don't even want to be around that because they're not making the money. They're not benefiting from it. They kind of probably don't want you to do it. Like my non-drug dealer friends used to come around me only to talk me out of it. And I wasn't a person that was like hand-to-hand combat on the block all the time. I was kind of pushed away. So like even me being pushed away and just monitoring some of these different things, your non-drug dealing friends are like, yo, you can do this and do that and start a business. And you know, everybody's like a barbershop and you can get a barbershop, a liquor store, and then, you know, work our way up to liquor store that you can get a haircut in, you know, but it's always like some type of idea. It's always some type of idea to pull you away from the street. So I think that was a very, very, very great observation and how that was placed.
Yeah. I mean, Devante and Brandon Ross, they have records, but we're just looking at the plain hard evidence that morning, Sunday, very early in the morning, the three of them are walking together from the train station at Pensy and North. And none of it added up to any of Freddie's traditional alleged dealing behavior. So that's where all of that came from, you know? And then they never found any drugs. So that's kind of why it was connected to the knife. You know, obviously they looked really hard. You can see it on the CCTV. It wasn't brought up at trial. From what I gather from everything I've learned about the state's attorney's office, I don't even know if they know. Or if they do know, they found a way not to deal with that fact because it was inconvenient for them. But there's no evidence of dealing that morning. And actually, we're going to talk a lot about Freddie's record because it's very upsetting. I mean, there's a lot of questionable probable cause statements in his history, so that when the media learns about this death of a black man in police custody and they get a list of all of his arrests, not all of those arrests were prosecuted, not all of those arrests were valid.
You just heard the number. You heard the number 18 all over again, right? You kept hearing 18, 18, 18, 18, 18.
Can I jump in on this?
Because sure.
This is a big issue. I mean, Maryland has a public case search. If you just Google Maryland case search, it comes up and you can put somebody's name in and you see all the times that they've been charged with a crime and you see the result of those crimes. Now, this is a great tool, but it's also really problematic because if you're somebody who's been arrested a bunch and it didn't go to conviction, you're trying to get a job, somebody just puts your name into case search and 18 things come up. They're not going to bother going through there to see what, you know, what comes up. And the rate of dismissals of cases, I don't know the percentage rate, but it's high. I mean, there are so many cases that we have that are charged. People are sitting in jail waiting with, you know, high bails or even low bails that they can't pay, or they're sitting on violations of probation, no bail bench warrants, because they got cases that get dismissed. They get dismissed for all sorts of reasons.
And from an employer's perspective, the system doesn't make mistakes.
Right. Yeah, so it might have been dismissed, but you were probably guilty and it got dismissed for some other reason is how they would, you know, I would think they would think about it. You look like a bad guy if you've got 18 cases against you, or you look like a drug dealer if you got 18 cases against you, or a thief, or a batterer, or whatever, you know, whatever the majority of the cases are. It makes you look like a bad guy, but none of that takes into consideration all these arrests that were made without probable cause, you know, or cases that they come back.
The average employer doesn't know that O'Malley's responsible for 700,000 illegal arrests.
Right.
They don't know that, but they just see that you're one of those arrests.
Well, and you might be arrested with something on you that the officer in their, you know, vast training and experience looks like this substance, and it comes back as no CDS. So the case just gets dismissed, but nobody knows why it gets dismissed. I mean, this is why there's all this big work with expungements nowadays, and laws have been changing in Maryland regarding expungements to try to get those dismissals cleared up off your public record, because it looks bad. Yeah. Whether you're guilty,
like, as soon as your name comes up, it's kind of like a shadow over you,
like a legal knife, right? But a legal knife,
and that, so then you have a weapons charge on you. You look like a dangerous person.
I want to bring up a little. You guys were talking about Brandon Ross, and I just happened to have pulled up the what I wrote about when he took the stand, and some of the line of questioning that Nero's lawyer, his name was Mark Zayon, asked him. He said, is it fair to say there's drug selling in Gilmore Homes? And Ross said, where are drugs not being sold in Baltimore City? And Zan said, okay, well, is there crime in Gilmore Homes? And Ross said, there's crime in the whole world. And, you know, that's the way that he set the questions up, which is like this, it's this terrible place that's crime ridden, so the police were free to do whatever they want. And then they brought up the fact that Ross lied when he called 911. He didn't give them, I think, his real name. He gave a fake name. And he said, the reason why I didn't give my real name is because I knew I was going to be messed with and harassed by police. Which
doesn't happen, because police officers, because we walk around with this illusion of the hero cop. I'm not just going to, you know, talk about what happens in Baltimore, but like, I'm just going to blame like America in general. Why do we romanticize the police officers so much? It needs to stop. It's a job. It's a job.
Well, and, you know, these officers and people in the neighborhoods know each other pretty well, yeah. Right? Because, you know, officers are, at least in Baltimore City, are divided in geographic district. And so it's the same officers patrolling and policing the same neighborhoods. And so it's the same officers that are harassing people over and over again. So if you're staying in, hanging out with your friends on the street corner, you get harassed or arrested by one officer, he's probably the same officer that arrested you last week for hanging out and loitering or, exactly, you know, spitting on the sidewalk or whatever it is. You know, these people, they know you, they know where you live, they know your mom, they know your brother. And so if you call and you make a complaint and you give your name, you know, officer gonna know you complain about him. So then when you see that officer on the street the next day, that officer doesn't care. You complain about him in the sense, he's not going to get in trouble for it, but he's sure going to take it out on you.
And let's put this in context for our listeners. This is in the middle of a culture where police officers are known for planting drugs on people, picking at people, and locking up who they want to lock up for whatever crime. This happens. It's a real thing. It's a nightmare.
Well, we just had that indictment. Right. In Baltimore City with all these.
I've been covering Daniel Herschel for like at least 3 years. Like, I know. So when I saw it, I was happy, but I'm like, yo, what about the Puntain's article? What about Soderbergh's article? What about my article? Like, we've been exposing the devilish actions and nobody does anything. But I'm finally glad they stepped in now.
I mean, every one of the attorneys in my office who have had experience with him, no one was surprised. They're like, oh, yeah, I know him. Like, finally it caught up to him. And the balls on these officers, knowing that they're getting wiretapped, and to be like, oh, well, all these other officers that got caught, they didn't get in too much trouble. They only got this amount of time.
The Herschel stories are nightmarish. Like, I'm not going to say anyone's name, you know, but I've heard stories about him making a pregnant woman lie on her stomach, you know. I've heard stories about him, and I'm not even talking about, we know it's public record that he broke arms and jaws and slapped a woman with, but like, we know that's public record. We know this. This public record. This is not, you go to Baltimore Sun, do a simple Google search, you'll see these things. But I'm talking about the stories of going inside somebody's house, maybe a grandmother's house, and just breaking apart everything. This is like, some of this stuff is like renaissance. Some of this stuff is like stuff that you had in your family for a long time. Just wrecking stuff. And just because you're on some type of living out your wild hero cop stealing cowboy dreams.
How many of those go unreported, right? Because if that's what you do for no reason, what's the retaliation going to be like?
It's also subscribed to that same dehumanization that exists within police culture in general. Like, what if I walked inside a police officer's house with some steel boots on, drop kicked that flat screen TV, and then DDT his wife, you know, and then just left out, well, you know, and everything's good. Then a guy that Ryder Watkins is the most horrible Negro ever. Do you know what he did to Officer Herschel?
You'd be a monster.
He body slammed his wife and he spit in Herschel's face, made him lie down, and then he kicked his flat screen TV while the Ravens were playing and broke it. And then he, you know, took a piss on a carpet and walked out. I look horrible, but a cop does this, and it's like, no, I mean, he's over. Maybe he's overworked. Maybe he needs counseling. Maybe the job's getting to him. Maybe it's a job for you. This is like, we got to live in this stuff.
I always think about when they post these pictures of like police officers, like posing with kids or posing with puppies. Like, no other industry, you know, D, you and I are writers. We don't have to go and like hug a tree to be like me. It's like, all you have to do is do your job, and you don't have to
job.
You don't have to go cha-cha slide, you know, down North Avenue. Like,
just do your job. Just do your job.
From talking to cops a lot, former Baltimore police officers mostly, what I've come to understand, and look, this is a problem all over the country, but I think Baltimore, from what I could tell, has one of the worst issues with this, which is just a culture of no accountability, of cover up instead of accountability. And when we talk about police training, the problem is they can write policies all day. I mean, Commissioner Batts was like pooping policies out left and right. Nothing was changing. The real kind of training has to be cultural. It has to be sort of about what are your values as a police officer? What is constitutionality? And what is a culture of accountability instead of cover up? And I know that that just sounds like, yeah, yeah. But I mean, from talking to experts about this, it seems like that change has to happen first. When you see something next to you that's wrong, you have to be instilled with this sense of needing to report it. And we know that in Baltimore, it's been sort of the opposite. I mean, we know the case of Joe Crystal. It was just a year before the Freddie Gray case, where he reported his supervisor using excessive force, and he and his wife were put through hell, and he was driven out of Baltimore, and Commissioner Batts was driving that car. So when you think about how do 6, 7, 8, 9 cops collide in covering up what happened to Freddie Gray, well, who's going to report on their supervisor after they know about that, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. It's a nightmare. So again, we need reform bad. And hopefully this information is making it to the right people. Would any of you ladies like to close with anything?
I mean, just on what we were just referring to, you know, something came to mind, and you can teach reform and, you know, teach people that they need to, you know, whistleblow or come up and, you know, say what's going on or stop somebody from going over the top. But as soon as these young officers, they get out of training and they're paired up with someone who's been on the force for years, who, you know, is the one that they're riding in the car with, you know, I think all that goes out the window. You know, you have somebody turning to you and you're like, well, I know that's what they told you at training, but here's how it is on the street, right? And
training day.
It's training day. It's ingrained. And it, you know, I don't know how you fix that when the people who are on a day-to-day training these new cadets, new officers, are people who have been brought up through the system with that state of mind. I don't know how you train that unless you get rid of all the old guys and start from scratch.
Mm. Lisa?
I keep trying to figure out if I'm an optimist or not. And I think it's about half and half. And I think the part of me that takes this colossal mess and tries to find some good in it is, you know, things like this, things like the work that Justine's doing, hopefully some of the stuff that I've written, is, you know, that there will be young people like you and like that can get into the legal system, because this really felt like a trial that didn't fit within the system at all. And there needs to be a lot of the boring, routine, you know, not sexy, not fun groundwork where people can get into the system, become lawmakers and writers and, you know, even police officers maybe, I don't know, and figure out how to reconcile this so that there is at some point justice. And I remember I was at a crime symposium a little while ago, and people were talking about two different realities for police officers. One in which a lot of white officers feel very like put upon now and everyone hates us. Black officers don't really feel like that. They feel they can see both sides. So I'm hoping that some of those black officers or some of the other black people within the system can do what can be done. And maybe at some point, maybe when all of us are dead, I don't know, but there can be some justice for somebody.
Okay, great. So where can we find you guys at, starting with Justine?
My Twitter handle is at Jewstein, J-E-W-S-T-E-I-N 3000.
Lisa?
I'm at Lisa McCray on Twitter, and also I'm writing at Baltimore City Paper.
Sarah?
I don't have a Twitter.
What?
How? I'm gonna you can find her in the courtroom. You can find me in the courtroom.
You can find me in court. I don't want to find you there.
You can find me in court.
Wonderful, inspiring, a little painful, but optimistic conversation today with Justine Barron, who's always great, Sarah Elkins, and Lisa Snowden McCray. Fans, you can participate in the social media discussion with the hashtag undisclosed or the hashtag Freddie Gray. Tag questions for future addenda with the hashtag UDAddendum. Follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle at undisclosed POD. Thank you and have a great day.
The Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins was recorded at the Moose House Recording Studio in Baltimore. Big thanks to Ernesto and Ryan at Moose House for setting us up. Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media produced the addendum, along with super producer Methil Telhan. Thanks to our sponsors for this week, Mack Weldon, You Keep Me Comfortable, and I can't express my appreciation enough. I can't say the same about Latote, because I don't wear women's clothing, but Amelia tells me great things. Make sure you check out our sponsors. We wouldn't endorse a product that we ourselves didn't use or believe in. Patrick Cortez composed the Undisclosed Addendum's theme music, and the embed track is Timeless by FMG Dez, a Baltimore artist. Don't forget to check out regular episodes of Undisclosed every Monday at 6 p.m. You can still drive the conversation on social media using the hashtag Freddie Gray, hashtag Undisclosed, at our handle, Undisclosed Pod. We are on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Lastly and leastly, the executive producer of Undisclosed is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Monday for episode 6 of Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. Until then,